I'm Connie Kasry from UCLA, and we're going to switch gears a little bit. That study was our first SMART, and we learned a lot from it, and I'll try to, you know, maybe talk a little bit about sort of what we learned from that. But I want to shift gears and talk about a rescue protocol for slow responders. So what Danny alluded to in our new design, where we do something we call the rescue, and some of you may be offended by that, but it's kind of a word that comes from other areas of mental health. So when a child is slowly responding or non-responding to a treatment, you want to do something to rescue their progress. All right. So the issue is that researchers, clinicians, parents all recognize that for interventions, one size doesn't fit all. So given that situation, when and how do we make decisions about what to change in an intervention? So this is really clinical decision making in practice, and Danny also alluded to this. So sometimes, even when a child is not making progress, we kind of stick to the protocol as researchers, even though we would like to change something, right? And traditionally, researchers are very concerned about staying with the protocol and fidelity to that protocol. But in practice, we want to know what progress is the child making. And so there's this tension between what researchers, you know, study and want to know and what people in clinical practice want to know. And we want to know that too, it's just that we get stuck sometimes. So to reiterate, we're concerned with helping children who are minimally verbal and are school-aged to talk more. So school-aged meaning this sort of window between 5 and 8, that's what we've selected as our window of school. And we're really interested in spontaneous communication via the spoken language or with the augmentative device. And we're interested in functions other than just responding to someone or requesting behavior. So the children that we're seeing also are children who've already been exposed to early interventions. And some of the children have been exposed to really large doses of top-notch treatments. And I want to, I guess we haven't said that before, but all of these children, one of the inclusionary criteria is that they've had to have had at least 2 years of early intervention. Because it's a big difference if you've had no access to any early intervention, right? And I think that's important because we have this belief that we just need to give children early intervention. They're all going to make sufficient progress, and most of them do. But there's a percentage of children who still aren't really talking very much by the time they enter school, even though they've had access to all of those interventions. So we really need to, you know, think about that and think what it is that we can do as researchers, as clinicians, to help put all children on a positive trajectory. So we've learned a lot from that previous SMART trial. So as you know, I don't need to repeat what we did because you've just heard about it. But we did learn that the children's outcomes were better with the speech generating device on that important outcome of spontaneous communication, and it mattered that we started with the speech generating device right from the beginning. If children made slow progress, we re-randomized them to either augmentation or to the addition of the speech generating device. Clinicians, however, so even though we sort of did this in a very systematic experimental way, clinicians sometimes felt like their assessment of the whether the child was a responder or a non-responder didn't fit with how the children tested. And that was a problem with our sort of selecting these standardized tests and being very systematic about going into the next randomization. So, you know, we wanted to think about what we could add in that would matter, and also what kind of measures we could use besides experimental measures. And we also wanted to add other kinds of treatments. So we only used this JASP EMT treatment, thinking that that was going to make a big difference. But there were children we felt needed something much more structured, might have benefited from discrete trial training, or DTT, both for reducing behaviors or anxiety, for example. And we wanted to think about other kinds of strategies that we could pull in. So that information influenced our next treatment. So we chose two initial treatments, both evidence-based, to improve language outcomes. One was discrete trial training, and one was the JASP EMT treatment. DTT because we felt like children would have had 2 years of early intervention, and it was possible that they were familiar with DTT or some other kind of ABA kind of intervention, and that might be more comfortable for them in which to make progress. And we wanted to give them very systematic, high-quality discrete trial training, hence why Tris Smith is involved in this next trial. And then we used JASPMT because it was shown to be efficacious from our last trial. So all children were also given access to the communication system, right? So we learned from that last trial that everyone benefited, or children benefited more if they had access to a speech-generating device. And in this new trial, the majority of, most DTT programs use PECS, or Picture Exchange Communication System, which is an augmentative communication system. So that would be involved in the DTT intervention where we use the speech generating device with JASPMT. Okay, so we also learned that we could expect pretty quick progress. In about 24 to 30 sessions, we would expect that children would make progress for about half of the children. So we expected about half of our children to be fast responders and half to be slow responders. All right, so the issue for the slow responders is that maybe some children just need more time or that the intervention needs augmentation. So to augment the slow responders in the new study, we decided to create a rescue protocol. So it may be that children need a combination of both the discrete trial training and the JASPMT, and maybe some other components or other strategies as well. But we wanted to use manualized evidence-based treatments, right? We want to pull from those different tested strategies. So this is the new design. It's a little crazy. So I can't even see it, actually. So, but in the first randomization, we're randomizing to either what we call core DTT, so sort of the beginning solid DTT programs that most people start with, and then or to JASPMT. After about 24 to sessions, so these now we've changed and are in schools, and we're seeing children every single day. And so that number of sessions gets finished in about 6 weeks. So in 6 weeks, we feel like we have enough sessions that we can determine if a child is on a pathway to being a fast responder or a slow responder. If they're a fast responder, as Danny said, they're going to get augmented with parent training in the home, as well as the school-based treatment. Or they're just going to stay the course so we can understand whether parent training adds something. And then if they're a slow responder, those kids could just stay the course because they need more time, or they could get this rescue protocol. So for children who receive that rescue protocol, it could be a combination of all the different treatments as appropriate, so that we're trying to move children onto this positive trajectory. These rescue protocols are highly individualized, and they're culled from these existing manualized evidence-based protocols. So given that highly individualized nature, how do we systematize or document change? So, you know, we're not just wanting to go into a treatment that has a lot of different components that could never be replicated by a clinician in the field. So there's some precedent for this. So we're looking at other areas of outside of autism, and there's something called a dashboard for a mapping treatment plan in progress, mostly used in other areas of childhood disorders. And it involves clinical decision making. So there's a balance of evidence-based planning and then informed adaptation when you use this sort of approach. It's really thinking about using these evidence-based modules and the idea of distilling down the kinds of strategies you want to use and then matching it to the child's individual characteristics based on their early response. All right. So it looks something like this. This is work done by Bruce Chirpita out of the University of California. And it really, it's interesting that, so each week of treatment, you would document exactly what you're doing. So down the one side, we've got a list of different kinds of strategies that are pulled from evidence-based practices. And this is not ours. This is used with anxiety disorders, aggression, and depression. So there may be a lot of different strategies that you're going to pull in at different times over the course of the rescue protocol. And the rescue protocol actually would occur for the next 10 weeks, right? So this is a 4-month intervention from beginning to end of treatment and then a follow-up phase. So you can document the progress each week and you can identify those kinds of strategies that you're using. So we're not there to using this completely. This is a commercialized project or protocol. And what we're trying to do now is to think about how we're going to do this. So we've developed similar kinds of data sheets to map our treatment planning for an individual child using components of each treatment. So maybe some DTT, maybe some Jasper, maybe some EMT, maybe some other kinds of behavioral regulation strategies. And we talk about the delivery details. Maybe we want to work on the floor, maybe we want to work at the table, right? We might pull in different elements, but we want to document that. So that planning is really well documented, as well as the evidence of our attempts, right? So we collect data. Information from each week feeds into planning for the next week, with the primary goal of making child progress on this particular outcome measure of spontaneous communication. And our data sheets look like that, and I don't expect you to read it. So we have session logs that then we input into our data management system, and it has a rescue daily session log. So we talk about the number of sessions we complete that week, the number of sessions missed, et cetera, whether we use the AAC or some other kind of augmentative system, and details about that. We talk about joint engagement routines, how are they doing in that, what kind of structure did we need, and comments. If our joint attention gesture target, what we're targeting, how often the child does these different things, what we might want to think about changing. The same thing with our DTT, which oftentimes, depending on whether the child is a slow responder to DTT or a slower responder to JASBMT, we might use it as a priming method. We might prime a little bit in the very beginning of the intervention, or we might embed it. It really depends on the child, and we want to document that. And then we have our child language targets. So we talk about what our target words are and how that's going, how that's put together and how it's going. So do I have time for a little brief clip? Okay. So this is a child that was in, so right now, you know, I don't have data that I can actually show you, but we are expecting about half of our kids to be slow responders, and we're on target for that. All right. We want that kind of those numbers so that we can actually have more subjects in those later cells. So this is a little guy from one of our sites, which I don't know, Anne, how'd you figure out how to do it? Ah, there we go. This is him at week 7. So this is the first week of rescue. So he's already not progressed in the main intervention.
In the bucket.
Oops. It's so touchy. It is so touchy. Anyway, in that first clip, he's mouthing toys a lot, right? So he's at a very young developmental age in terms of his toy play, and we're just working on trying to get him engaged. Okay. So this is him at the end of rescue. And I want to just point, oh my goodness. I want to point out that he is a very slow responder even in rescue. Let's see if that'll work. I swear. Or I won't swear.
On the tower. Want the tower.
Tower.
Make a tower. No tower.
Tower.
Pig.
Okay. Okay, so we got him to point for a request. We didn't get much joint attention. We got some intentional communication, and that's the point. So the goal is for us to make use of this clinical dashboard system that's already developed, and we're just adapting what we're doing within that clinical dashboard, and we're working with Bruce Chirpita on that. What we hope to learn from this trial is what it takes to put all children who are minimally verbal on a positive developmental trajectory, and really understanding the ways in which treatments can be adapted to further delineate our evidence-based practices and the future of effective treatments for children with ASD. Thank you. And this is our new group of investigators. Thank you. Steve, I can't see that far away. Hi.
Sorry. Thanks, Connie. So for your vision of how these sort of rescue protocols may have implications for future treatment, is the vision that it's a protocol that can be implemented in later dissemination, or that it'll feedback to modify your treatments to improve treatment matching from the very beginning of treatments in the future?
Ah, good question. So hopefully it'll feedback into thinking about how we might select a treatment, right? Am I right? I'm looking at Danny because he's my smart design person. But I would think that we want to learn whether or not this kind of combined method might be particularly helpful for certain kinds of children. So I think we'll learn which children are fast and slow responders and which ones benefit from different sequences of treatment, including that rescue protocol. So I would think that it would all feed back in. And we're trying to make it, we're documenting all these details so that we can actually replicate something. It may be that we end up doing the same rescue protocol for all of the kids. I don't know.